pressed, and it's just like, okay, I just got to sing out and remind my soul that God is good. And I want to give us just a second just to just kind of talk to God. I know that some of you might have a lot of things on your mind right now. Maybe you've got that you have to rush home and make some dips or wings or something for the big game. But I want to make sure that we're ready to listen and hear God. And so before we just jump too far into the talk, I want to give us just a moment just to remind our soul, just to kind of cry out to God, to talk to Him, and just say, God, would you speak to my heart? And if you're here tonight and maybe you're wrestling with God, maybe you're doubting if He exists, maybe this is the time for you just to say, hey, God, if you're real, would you remind me? Would you show me? And so I want to give you guys a few moments just to talk to God. Would you guys pray? And God, we ask that you would speak to our hearts tonight in a personal way. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, tonight we conclude our series entitled Risk. And the main idea of the series is that God has wired you to do more than what most of us are probably doing. God has wired you to live an exciting story. But in order to do that, you're going to have to trust that God is who He says He is and that God can do all the things that God has said He can do. And in order to do that, you're going to have to take a risk. Throughout the last couple of weeks, we've been going through the story of David and Goliath, or David versus Goliath, I should say. And while we've been going through that, we've been looking at the definition of what a story is. I want to look at that one more time. A story is a character who wants something and overcomes conflict to get it. A story is a character that wants something and overcomes conflict to get it. 2 weeks ago, we were introduced to David. David was a little shepherd boy. His dad sends him to the battlefield, not to fight, but to bring food for his brothers. And he shows up at the battlefield, he drops the food off, and as he's at the battlefield, he hears this giant, and this giant defies the armies of the living God. And this is a problem. David just has something rise up in his soul that says, this is wrong. Everyone else is scared, everyone else is running for their lives, but like, this can't be. And from that, we talked about that in our lives, if we want to live a great story, we've got to ask, what is the problem? What is it in our world that is a problem? What's bothering us? What's stirring in us? What is it that should not be because we are a part of the living God? Then there's a second question, though, that we had to ask ourselves. And that second question is, what's the need that's being ignored? And it wasn't enough for David just to say, hey, this is wrong that this giant's doing this. He actually had to do something. And so David starts saying, hey, what's going to happen when someone takes down this giant? What is he going to get? And he started like making noise and asking these questions. And that's when we were introduced to David. He was the character in the story. And he wanted something. And what he wanted was to take down this giant. But then last week, we looked at the second part of this definition, which is, overcomes conflict to get it. Now, the conflict, a lot of people think the conflict is Goliath in the story. But before he even got to Goliath, there was some conflict that he had to deal with. Right when he starts talking about taking down this giant, his older brother, Eliab, starts putting him down and saying, you can't do this, you're here for the wrong reasons, just kind of making fun of him and tearing him down. And David could have stopped this story there. He could have said, okay, you're right, I'm a loser, no one likes me, I'm just going to go back home to my sheep. But instead of doing that, he turned the other way. He didn't listen to Eliab, and his story was forever changed because he didn't listen to the negative criticism in his life. From that, we ask the same question. If we're going to live a great story, we're going to have to overcome some conflict. And for hopefully some of you guys went and you forgave your Eliabs. Hopefully you forgave the people who have put you down who may have been stopping your story. And so that was last week. And this week we're going to continue on in the story of David and Goliath. And we're going to continue on with the idea of living a great story because it is going to take some risk in order to do that. And the main idea of tonight's talk is if you want what few people have, you have to be willing to do what few people are willing to do. If you want what few people have, you have to be willing to do what few people are willing to do. I first heard that quote from Pastor Craig Groeschel, and I think it is an amazing quote. In fact, it's become one of my favorite quotes, but it's not just a great quote. It is actually a biblical idea. Jesus said that there are two roads. There's the wide road that everybody's going to take, and there's the narrow road that very few people are going to take. But if you want to follow after Jesus, you got to go down the narrow road. it's this exact same idea. If you want what few people have, you have to be willing to do what few people are willing to do. Now, we've been talking about and wrestling with this idea of living a great story. And the truth is, I think that all of us in here want to live a good story. I think all of us in here have this idea of, yeah, I want to do something greater than myself. But very few of us are actually going to do the work necessary in order to live a great story. In fact, 2 weeks ago, we gave a specific application for something for you to do. And I only heard one person actually apply the talk. Hopefully more than that did, but I only heard of one. And then last week, we had specific application for the talk of something that was going to help you write an amazing story. And I didn't hear of anyone applying the talk. Maybe you did. Maybe you're just silent about it. That's cool. But the point is if you are just going to sit and listen to a talk and say, yeah, that's good, you're going to do what everyone else does. But if you want to see God move, if you want to live an incredible story, you have to be willing to do what few people are willing to do. And that is, you have to go the extra mile. You have to actually put the talk in the application. You have to actually do what it says. I really do believe that every single one of us in here have deep down inside of us a desire to be great. And the reason that I think that is because when you get in certain environments, you rise to the occasion. For example, if you have company over at your house, most of you probably make sure your house looks spick and span. Now, it doesn't matter if you live in a junkyard for all the other days of the year. When someone's coming over, you want them to think that your house is like spick and span clean. You want them to think that they could eat off the floor, so you clean up. Why? You want people to think that you're great. There's something inside of us. When you go to certain environments, maybe you're going to the store, to Food Lion, and you don't care if people judge you, and so you wear your slippers out and your PJs and a sweatshirt, and you don't care about it. But I bet there is some place that you go that before you go, you look at your whole wardrobe of clothes and you say, I have nothing to wear. Why do you say that? Because you feel this pressure. I want them to think that I'm great. I want to impress them with what I have. There is something inside of us that wants to be great. But if you want what few people have, you have to be willing to do what few people are willing to do. I know that none of us like to think about death, but there are a few guarantees in this world. Death, taxes, and morning breath. Morning breath happens. It doesn't matter how late at night you brush your teeth. You're going to wake up and your breath is going to be kicking like Chuck Norris. I'm telling you, it just happens. You can brush your teeth two times before you go to bed. It doesn't matter. We all wake up and our breath smells like death died. It's awful. It's a guarantee. It's going to happen every morning. Taxes. We've all experienced taxes. Hopefully none of us have experienced death, but it's coming. We're going to experience death one day. And when you die, the only thing that you're going to leave that is worth anything is your story. When we think about the next generation, we often think about what inheritance are we going to leave. And hopefully you're planning for that inheritance. You're saving something. And we think, you know, I'm going to leave my kids the house, or I'm going to leave them a little bit of money. But did you know after a few generations, they're not even going to think about that house or that little cash you gave them? The only thing they're going to remember is the story, the legacy that you left them. I mean, just think about this. You don't have to raise your hand. It's just a rhetorical question. But how many of you even know the name of your great great grandparents? How many of you know their names? Like, I don't. I know my grandpa. I don't even know if I know his real name. His grandpa. Like, I know some things about my grandpa. I know some things about my grandma. But I don't know anything about his parents. And I know nothing about his great grandparents or his grandparents. Like, why? You say, oh, because you weren't around, because they were old. No, that's not true. I know lots of facts about lots of dead people. So do you. We know tons of facts about dead people and people that were around when we weren't around. Why do we know things about people who died already? It's because they left an amazing story. But somewhere down the line, even our flesh and blood got just so used to living the mundane that they didn't leave anything worth talking about. And the reason that we don't know our grandparents and our great-grandparents and our great-great-great-grandparents is because the legacy that they left was probably just built on maybe some money or some homes. But I want us as a church to leave a legacy that is far greater than that. I mean, think about it. We've been going through this story of David and Goliath. Do you know how long ago this story was? This wasn't like it happened like 20 years ago or 50 years ago or 100 years ago. This happened thousands of years ago. Like, Jesus came on the scene 2,000 years ago, and this happened thousands of years before Jesus. Think about how long ago that was. And yet here we are still talking about this little shepherd boy who fought this giant. Why? Because he lived an amazing story. He did what few people were willing to do. And so that's the main idea of tonight, and I want to catch us up just in case you've missed the last couple weeks. Last week where we ended was David goes before King Saul, and King Saul looks at him and says, "You can't fight this giant. You're just a little boy, and this giant has been fighting since he was a little kid. You're going to lose." And that's where we left off last week, and let's pick up right there and see what David says. This is David's response to King Saul. "But David said to Saul, 'Your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and carried off a sheep from the flock, I went after it, struck it, and rescued the sheep from its mouth. When it turned on me, I seized it by its hair, struck it, and killed it. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, because he has defied the armies of the living God. The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine.' And Saul said to David, 'Go, and the Lord be with you.'" Now let's just stop there for a second. So Saul tells David that he can't beat this giant named Goliath. And did you catch how David responded? He was like, "Man, this uncircumcised Philistine, he's not going to hurt me. He can't stand in my way. Let me give you my resume. Here's my resume. I'm this little shepherd boy, but one time a lion took away one of my sheep. And you know what I did? I caught up to the lion, I grabbed the sheep from its mouth, and then when the lion turned on me, I killed it with my bare hands. Take that, Saul. Oh, if that's not enough for you, let me add this to my resume. I killed a bear. Have you ever killed a bear? I didn't think so." And like, David is just like throwing, he has such confidence, and I love it. Like, I can just see this little shepherd boy. I would be so intimidated if I was in the presence of a king. I would have just been stuttering and saying, "One day I killed a lion," but not David. He's like, "Dude, I killed a lion and a bear." And here's the thing, the reason that David had such confidence is because he was willing to live an amazing story even when nobody was looking. Today in our culture, so many of us want to live a great story when people are looking, or we want to do something great if it's going to make us famous. But very few of us are willing to do what few people are willing to do. And that means you got to do the hard work. That means you got to live a great story even when no one is looking. David had no idea that one day he was going to fight a giant and it was going to be in the spotlight. All he knew that his job was to protect the sheep. And even though no one was looking, his dad wasn't around, his family wasn't around, he said, "Those are my sheep, I've got to protect them. And so with God's strength, I'm going to go and I'm going to fight a lion and I'm going to fight a bear." I read not too long ago a very interesting article that interviewed graduating seniors from high school. And the article was saying that years past, the number one thing that graduating seniors from high school said that they wanted to be were things like doctors, lawyers, sometimes might have been like actors or athletes, but it was always something that we would think of as like, you know, that's a good aspiration, that's a good job. But the number one thing coming out of high school seniors that they said they wanted to be was famous. That's not even a job, it's just famous. That's what they wanted to be. And we've seen it in our culture with the rise of things like reality TV and YouTube. We've seen people that offer absolutely nothing to our society, and yet they've become incredibly famous. They have no skills, they have nothing like to add to the landscape, and yet they're like incredibly famous. Everybody knows their names. But here's the deal. You can become famous, but that's not going to leave a legacy. In 50 years, nobody's going to be talking about, "Hey, let me tell you about my dad. When my dad was 27 years old, he used to fist pump with the best of them on the Jersey Shore. It was awesome." Nobody's going to be telling that story. Nobody cares. That's not a legacy worth leaving. And I want to challenge us to live an amazing legacy for our kids. I want us to live such an amazing life, not just when people are looking, not when someone's watching over you and looking over your shoulder, but I want you to do what you're supposed to do even when no one's looking. Why? Because ultimately we're not living a great story to become famous. We're living a great story for God's glory. I love what a New Testament author says. Look at it with me. This comes from Colossians. It says, "Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart, as working for the Lord, not for men. Since you know that you will receive an inheritance from the Lord as a reward, it is the Lord Christ you are serving." So whatever you do, who are you to work as to? Not unto fame, not unto fortune, not unto people praising you. Everything that you do, whatever it is, you are to work as it unto the Lord. That's how you live a great story. Now here's the thing that's amazing about David. If David never had the opportunity to fight Goliath, he would still have lived an amazing story. Think about that. Think about, like, he could sit around and tell his kids, "Let me tell you about the day when I was a boy and I fought a lion. Let me tell you about the day when I fought a bear." David lived an incredible story. He wasn't waiting for the spotlight to get on him. He wasn't waiting for YouTube to discover him. He wasn't waiting for someone like of fame and fortune to look at him. David lived a great story. And if you want what few people have, you have to be willing to do what few people are willing to do. And that means that you've got to live a great story even if you're never famous. Even if no one's looking at you, you've got to live a story and give God the glory. Why? Because you are working not unto man, but unto God. One of my favorite things about the story of Next Level Church is that the church was started off of a blog post. And I love telling people that story because their eyes get really big and they're just like, they don't get it. Because there are some people who are into blogging and there are other people who think it's a really nerdy like thing that nerds do. And so like I love telling people, like people will ask me, I'll go to these conferences or I'll go to these meetings and they'll say, tell me, how did you start your church? Well, I put a blog post out and 90 people showed up to an interest meeting from one blog post. One blog post? Are you serious? But what I don't get to tell them is the behind the scenes of this blog. I started a blog in April of 2008, and I started it, and I didn't know how to blog. I didn't read hardly any blogs at the time. No one ever sat me down and taught me how to blog. I wanted to write, and my main purpose was to make people laugh in order to connect people with Jesus. That's why I wanted to blog. I wanted to just write things that people thought were funny so that when I came around and I wrote a more serious post that had to do with Jesus, they would actually stick around. Because I knew that if I just came out and started talking about Jesus, like, not very many people would read it. But I thought if I could just hook them, if I could just make them laugh, then they'll stick around and they'll read the Jesus posts. And so on April, about the middle of April 2008, I wrote the very first blog post. And back then, my blog was not called robshep.com. It was called robshepsblog.blogspot.com. I think you can tell why I changed the name. No one could remember that. But I want to read to you my very first blog post from April of 2008. Just get ready to be inspired and wowed by this pathetic attempt of a blog. I can't believe this is what I was like, I'm going to jump into the World Wide Web. Hello, world. This is what I wrote. This is awful. It says, I don't care if I'm 29 years old. There's something really funny about people saying the word duty, D-U-T-Y. It is close to the childhood word for feces called duty. The first time I laughed about the word was when my wife said she had bus duty at school. I responded with, bus duty is one of the worst kinds to have, and then I laughed. Yesterday at church, there was duty everywhere. Our pastor said in all three services that some of our volunteers were working double duty. I don't know about you, but the thought of double duty is pretty funny. Then last night at 6 p.m. service, one of the volunteers started talking to me about double duty. I am mature enough to know not to laugh in their face when they say this, but I can't help but wonder why they didn't giggle after saying duty in a sentence. This is just my opinion, but I think you should keep your duty or duty to yourself. Whether it is ship duty, bus duty, double duty, late duty, early duty, jury duty, or any type of other duty, America, starting today, let's keep our duty to ourselves. That's not the type of blog post that inspires 90 people to come to an interest meeting to start a church. But this was my thing. I didn't know how to blog. No one taught me how to do it. I just had a desire to write. And really, I was just like, if I can just make some people laugh, then I'll be able to connect people to Jesus. And so I made a lot of mistakes, and I took a lot of risks on my blog. And for years, I blogged 5 days a week. And sometimes I wrote things, and people thought they were funny. Sometimes I wrote things, and people shook their head. Sometimes I got made fun of on my blog. Sometimes people told me it changed their life. But for years, I was consistent in writing. In fact, in 2012, 100,965 people read robshep.com. 100,000. Now, that is not to give me any praise at all. I don't know what I'm doing. I still don't know what I'm doing. It blows me away because when I wrote this duty post, my parents didn't even read it. Nobody read this thing. Nobody read it. But here's the point of this. I wrote not for an audience of anyone but God. I wrote because I wanted to connect people to Jesus. And even when no one was coming to my blog, I said, I'm going to write. I'm going to write, and hopefully somebody will end up reading it. And now that I have a little bit of a following, I can do things like just throw it out there and say, hey, I think God's leading me to plant a church. You want to come along for the ride? And 90 people will show up for an interest meeting. But that's the Goliath moment. It's years of prepping for that. It's years of doing things that you don't even see what God's doing, but God is wiring you right now. He is prepping you for your Goliath moment. And some of you are just thinking, well, I'm not getting the attention I deserve. No one's seeing my parenting skills. No one's seeing the time I'm putting in at my job. No one's giving me any praise that I deserve. But maybe God is just putting something inside of you. He is wiring you for your Goliath moment. And you've got to do what God has called you to do, even when no one is looking. If you want what few people have, you have to be willing to do what few people are willing to do. There are a handful of things that I think Next Level Church needs to be doing, even when no one's looking at us. Even when no one's paying attention to us, even when we're not even a year old, when we're in this size of a church, there are some things that I think that we should be doing, even if we don't get recognition, even if no one praises us. Here are some things that I think we need to be doing as if we're doing them unto God. Number one, make a difference to those who can't pay us back. Make a difference to those who can't pay us back. It is really easy in the church world or in the Christian life or just being human to do things in order for people to praise you. But why do we exist as a church? It's not for another church or another person to say, oh, Next Level is awesome. We exist to give Jesus praise. It is all about Jesus. So one of the best things that we can do is we can help people who can't pay us back. Let's make a difference in someone who can't pay us back, who can't write a nice story about us in the paper, or who can't give us money. Let's make a difference. Let's change someone's life. Let's pour Jesus into them, even if it won't benefit us. Number two, I think the second thing that we can do is pray privately for what we want to see God do publicly. Pray privately for what we want to see God do publicly. One day, I really do believe that we're going to have amazing stories come out of Next Level Church. I really do believe that one day we're going to just be able to say, man, we have seen hundreds of people come to know Jesus. And I think we're going to be able to say that we baptize hundreds of people. And I think we're going to be able to say that we help disciple like tons of people. Like people are really getting it. They're not just going to church. They're falling in love with Jesus. I think we're going to see all that. And I don't know if it's going to be in 5 years, in 10 years, in 20 years, or if it's going to be in 200 years. But I think the legacy of Next Level Church is that we really made a difference because of Jesus. But it's going to start when we start praying privately for what we want to see God do publicly. If you want to see God move, you don't wait until God moves. You ask God, hey, God, would you move in my life? If you want to see God save your lost friends and family, you don't wait until God saves them. You go and you pray privately. And you say, God, I am begging you, would you capture my husband's heart? Would you capture my wife's heart? Would you capture my kid's heart? Would you save my neighbor? You pray privately for what you want to see God do publicly. The third thing that I think we need to be doing is be faithful in the little things. It is easy to try to start being faithful when you're the top dog or when you're famous or when everyone's looking at you. But it's really hard to be faithful when you're a little shepherd boy and no one's watching you and you've been out in the field for like hours and hours and days and nights and no one's giving you praise and you see a lion come take one of your sheep. It's really easy just to say, ah, it's no big deal. It's just one sheep. You can have them. I'm not going to risk my life fighting a lion. But that's not what David did. And I think it's the same thing that we need to do. Don't sit back and say, oh, this is just church. Don't sit back and just say, oh, well, you know, I have my whole life to lead my neighbor to Jesus. Oh, I have my whole life to make a difference in the community. Don't say I have all this time to do it. You start making a difference right now. Be faithful in the little things. Here are some little things that we need to be faithful in. Reading our Bible. If you want to see God move, if you want to hear from God, you've got to build the discipline of reading your Bible. That's the little thing. And you think that that wouldn't be like that big of a deal to spend 5-10 minutes of your day. But I guarantee you, if we ask a room full of Christians, how many of you spent 3 days this week reading your Bible? Probably only a handful of hands would go up. But if you want what few people have, you got to be willing to do what few people are willing to do. And if few people are really reading their Bible and trying to hear from God, I would say that's one thing that we need to rise to the occasion and do. We've got to be faithful in the little things. And even if no one comes around you and says, oh, you're such an awesome Christian, or oh, you're a great person, we need to be faithful in the little things. Even when no one's looking, we need to do what God has called us to do. So David was faithful even when no one was watching him. And now he's on the world's greatest stage. It's like the whole world is watching what's about to go down. He's about to fight this big giant. He's gotten the approval of the king. And then this is what happens next. Let's pick up there. It says, then Saul dressed David in his own tunic. He put a coat of armor on him and a bronze helmet on his head. David fastened on his sword over the tunic and tried walking around because he was not used to them. I cannot go in these, he said to Saul, because I am not used to them. So he took them off. Then he took his staff in his hand, chose 5 smooth stones from the stream, put them in the pouch of his shepherd's bag, and with a sling in his hand, approached the Philistine. I love this part of the story because Saul was trying to make David into what he thought he should be. Saul was saying, no, if you're going to fight this guy, this is what you got to wear, this is what you got to do. But Saul wasn't willing to fight the giant. He was sending David out and he was trying to say, hey, you be more like me. I love the quote from Albert Einstein. Albert Einstein says that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. What do we do when it comes to the problems in our world? We try to do the exact same thing that everyone else does. We're not thinking, hey, let's do something radical. Let's just do something crazy. What do? Our teenagers are rebelling, and so we do what everyone else does. Oh, you just got to wait till they get out of the teenage years. Our marriage is falling apart. Oh, it's just a rough spot. We're not experiencing God's presence. Oh, I guess it'll come. We do the exact same thing that everyone else does, and then we wonder why we don't see results in our life. But if you want what few people have, you have to be willing to do what few people are willing to do. And that means that we can't do the same thing we've been doing over and over and over again. If David would have dressed like King Saul, he would have failed miserably. David had to take a risk, and the risk is going to fight this giant. But David had to say to himself, okay, I can't go out like you want me to go out. I can't wear your stuff. I know you're not going to understand this, but I got to go out as me. I got to go out here, and instead of using your sword and wearing your tunic, I'm going to go out in my clothes, and I'm going to take 5 smooth stones and a slingshot. This is radical. This doesn't make sense. Everybody would have said, no, you're crazy. What in the world are you doing? But David was not insane. David wanted to live an amazing story, and he knew that he had God on his side. And so David had to do something radical. He couldn't do what everyone else was doing. The definition of story is taken from Donald Miller's book, A Million Miles in 1,000 Years. And this book, I don't know if it's just Donald's writing style or just the idea of story, but this book has just, it captivated me. It is one of probably my favorite books that I've ever read, but it definitely was my favorite book that I read last year. And I told you guys this a couple weeks ago when I introduced the idea of story, but Donald is set to make a movie off of his first book, Blue Like Jazz. And he goes out to California, and he goes to this like seminar where they teach him what a story is. When he gets back from the seminar in L.A., he goes back to Portland, a friend of his picks him up from the airport. And what happens next in this story is so amazing. It is my absolute favorite part of this book. Instead of just telling it to you, I wanted just to read you this story. And I hope that story time with Rob will inspire you like this story inspired me. This chapter is titled, How Jason Saved His Family. When I got back from Los Angeles, I got together with my friend Jason, who had a 13-year-old daughter. He was feeling down because he and his wife had found pot hidden in their daughter's closet. She was dating a guy, too, a kid who smelled like smoke and only answered questions with single words like, yeah, no, whatever, and why. And why was the answer Jason hated most? Have her home by 10, Jason would say. Why, the guy would ask. Jason figured this guy was the reason his daughter was experimenting with drugs. You thinking about grounding her, I asked? Not allowing her to date him? We've tried that, but it's gotten worse, Jason shook his head and fidgeted his fingers on the table. Then I said something that caught his attention. I said his daughter was living a terrible story. What do you mean, he asked. To be honest, I didn't know exactly what I meant. I probably wouldn't have said it if I hadn't just returned from the McKee seminar. But I told him about the stuff I learned and that the elements of a story involve a character who wants something and overcomes conflict to get it. Even as I said this, I wasn't sure how it applied to his daughters or how his daughter. "Go on," my friend said. "I don't know exactly, but she's not living a very good story. She's caught up in a bad one." I said a lot of other things and he kept asking questions. We must have talked for an hour or more just about story, about how novels work and why some movies are meaningful and others simply aren't. I didn't think much of it. I just figured he was curious about movies. A couple months later, I ran into Jason and I asked about his daughter. "She's better," he said, smiling. And when I asked why, he told me his family was living a better story. The night after we talked, Jason couldn't sleep. He thought about the story his daughter was living and the role she was playing inside that story. He realized that he hadn't provided a better role for his daughter. He hadn't mapped out a story for his family, and so his daughter had chosen another story, a story in which she was wanted. And even if she was only being used, in the absence of family stories, she had chosen a story in which there was risk and adventure, rebellion and independence. "She's not a bad girl," my friend said. "She was just choosing the best story available to her." I pictured his daughter flipping through the channels of life, as it were, stopping on a story that seemed most compelling at the moment, a story that offered her something, anything, because people can't live without a story, without a role to play. "So how'd you get her out of it?" I asked, and I couldn't believe what he told me next. Jason decided to stop yelling at his daughter and instead created a better story to invite her into. He remembered that a story involves a character who wants something and overcomes conflict to get it. "I started researching some stuff on the internet," Jason said, "and I came across an organization that builds orphanages around the world. And that sounded to me like a pretty good ambition, something maybe my family could try to do together. It sounded like a good story." "Right," I said, trying to remember the elements of a story myself. "So I called this organization, Jason continued, "and it takes about $25,000 to build one of these orphanages. And the truth is, we don't have the money. I mean, we just took out a second mortgage. But I knew if we were going to tell a good story, it would have to involve risk." "That's true," I said, remembering it from the seminar. "So I went home and called a family meeting." My friend continued, "I didn't tell my wife first, which turns out was a mistake. But I told them about this village and about the orphanage and these terrible things that happen if these kids don't get an orphanage. Then I told them that I agreed to build it." "You're kidding me," I said. "No, I'm not." And my wife sat there looking at me like I'd lost my mind. And my daughter, her eyes were as big as melons, and she wasn't happy. She knew this would mean that she'd have to give up her allowance and who knows what else. They just sat there in silence. And the longer they sat there, the more I wondered if I'd lost my mind too. "I actually think you might have lost your mind," I said, feeling somewhat responsible. "Well, maybe so," Jason said, looking away for a second with a smile. "But it's working out. I mean, things are pretty good, Don." Jason went on to explain that his wife and daughter went back to their separate rooms, and neither of them talked to him. His wife was rightly upset that he hadn't mentioned anything to her. But that night, while they were lying in bed, he explained the whole story thing about how they weren't taking risks and weren't helping anybody and how their daughter was losing interest. The next day, he said, "Annie came to me while I was doing the dishes." He collected his words. "Things have been tense for about the last year. I haven't told you everything, Don, but my wife came to me, put her arms around me. She leaned her face into the back of my neck and told me she was proud of me." "You're kidding," I said. "I'm not," my friend said. "Don, I hadn't heard Annie say anything like that in years. I told her I was sorry I didn't talk to her about it, that I just got excited. She said she forgave me, but that it didn't matter. She said we had an orphanage to build and that we were probably going to make bigger mistakes, but we would build it." My friend smiled as he remembered his wife's words. And then Rachel came into our room, maybe a few days later, and she asked if she could go to Mexico. Annie and I just sort of looked at her and didn't know what to say. So then Rachel crawled between us in bed like she did when she was little. She said she could talk about the orphanage on her website and maybe people could help. She could post pictures. She wanted to go to Mexico to meet the kids and take pictures for her website. "That's incredible," I said. "You know what else, man?" Jason said. "She broke up with her boyfriend last week. She had his picture on her dresser and she took it down. She told me that he told her that she was too fat. Can you believe that? What a jerk." "A jerk," I agreed. But that's done now, Jason said, shaking his head. No girl who plays the role of a hero dates a guy who uses her. She knows who she is. She just forgot about it for a little while. I know it's a little bit of a risk to read an entire chapter to you and not just tell you the story, but I couldn't capture the words that Dan did, or Don did. Did you catch what happened? How many parents are dealing with a struggling teenager who is smoking pot and with like a bad boyfriend? And yet how many parents are willing to take a risk and do something extreme? This guy, Jason, was. He does some research and he finds out that there's an orphanage that they can build for $25,000 and they don't have the money, and he forgets to tell his wife that they're going to do this. He just presents it to the family. And they hated him for it. But a story is a character who wants something and overcomes conflict to get it, and he didn't stop with the fact that his wife and his daughter were mad at him. They kept on going towards his orphanage. And now his daughter is living a better story. And I just want to throw this out to you, that this guy Jason is not a biblical character. This guy Jason is not something that is like special or is different than you. If you want what few people have, you have to be willing to do what few people are willing to do. And right now, you are going to fight some big giants in your life. Maybe it is a wayward teenager, or maybe it's a wayward kid, or maybe it's a wayward spouse, or maybe it's finances, or maybe it's that you hate your job, or maybe it's that you don't know what your purpose in this life is, but you're going up against some giants in this world, and if you do what everybody else does, guess what you're going to do tomorrow? The same thing you did yesterday. But if you start thinking, hey, I'm wired for something different, I'm going to take a risk. I'm going to take a risk for God. And you start going at it at a different angle. You watch and see what God does in your life and how he changes your story. Let's keep reading the story now, because now David has Saul's permission to go and fight this giant. So let's pick up there. It says, meanwhile, the Philistine with his shield bearer in front of him kept coming closer to David. He looked David over and saw that he was only a boy, ruddy and handsome, and he despised him. He said to David, am I a dog that you would come at me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. Come here, he said, and I'll give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field. Now, I just want to mention to you that if a over 9 foot tall guy started cursing me out and making fun of my weapons, I probably would run the other way. And I would make the sound of Goofy. Like I would be scared. It would not be like, I would not rise up. But David knew he had a purpose. He had a reason to be there. And look how David responds. David said to the Philistine, you come against me with a sword and a spear and a javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will hand you over to me, and I'm going to strike you down, sucker, and cut off your head. Today I will give you the carcass of the Philistine army to the birds of the air and the beasts of the earth. And the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. All those gathered here will know that this is not by sword or spear that the Lord saves. For the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands. As the Philistine moved closer to attack him, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet him. Reaching into his bag and taking out a stone, he slung it and struck the Philistine on the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead, and he fell face down on the ground. So David triumphed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone. Without a sword in his hand, he struck down the Philistine, and he killed him. Today, without a doubt, you're standing before some giants in your life. And maybe the problem is that you're not battling them in the name of the Lord Almighty. David had no fear because he knew God was on his side. And maybe if you started bringing God into your problems and bringing God into your story, maybe God would give you a victory over some things. But you can't just sit around and say, okay, God, deliver me. One of the things that is so challenging about this story is we never read that God told David he was going to win this battle. We never read that God said, hey, David, you go do this, you're going to win. David never heard from God as far as we knew. David took a risk, and he took a risk for God, and he went out there and he fought this giant, and he won. You don't have any guarantees. You don't have any guarantees that you're going to have a victory over the giants in your life, but you do have the guarantee that God is on your side. And if you take some holy risks for God, I guarantee you that God's going to show up. He's going to show up in ways that you never even imagined. Tonight, I have two application questions that I want us wrestling with, and I don't want us just to think about them. I want us to actually do something about them this week. If you just think about them, you're doing what everyone else does. But if you want what few people have, you have to be willing to do what few people are willing to do. And The first application question is, what is preventing you from living the life God has for you? What is preventing you from living the life God has for you? What is the giant in your world? What is your excuse? Is it apathy? Is it that you just haven't had the right parents or the right money? Is it you haven't had the right opportunities? Like, what is it? What is it in your world that is preventing you from living the life God has for you? And the second question is this. What are you willing to do to get it? It's not enough just to say, yeah, I've got some problems. What are you willing to do? If you were Jason and your daughter was smoking pot and dating a rebellious boy, what would you have done? I think if we answer those two questions and we bring God alongside of our story and we fight these battles, we're going to see God do amazing things in our lives. But it's going to take some risk. And you have to be willing to do what few people are willing to do. But I believe in this next level. I think we can do it. And I can't wait to see how God creates amazing stories through us. Let's pray. God, thank you so much for your love. Thanks for, God, just this challenge. We desperately need you, God. We desperately need you to do more than we could ask or imagine. And we ask that you would just give us a heart and a desire to live an amazing story for you. Do more in us than we ever could dream. And God, right now, we just give you the glory because we do these things not for man's approval, we do them for you. We thank you and praise you for how you're going to move. In Jesus' name, amen.